Hello, this is Micro News, the podcast where Matt and I...
Hello.
...talk about some of the times microbiology has been in the news this month. Matt, do you want to start us off?
So, my first story might not be everybody's bag. I couldn't resist. It's about a new handbag created by French luxury fashion house Hermès. Now, you may be wondering what that's got to do with microbiology, but it will all become clear. In an effort to become more sustainable, the fashion industry has been pumping billions of dollars into research to create leather and plastic replacements. Fashion creates a huge amount of pollution, from synthetic fibres to animal leather production. Leather production can be very unsustainable. Even in fully modernised tanneries, it's nearly impossible to reclaim all the pollutants generated by the tanning process. Adrian Lopez Velarde, co-founder of Deserto, a Mexican company that makes leather look material from cactus, says as a rule of thumb, tanning 1 ton of hide results in 20 to 80 cubic meters of polluted wastewater, not to mention the offal effluents from preparation and pesticides to stop mold growth during transportation. As well as the environmental impact, customer attitudes are changing, and the concern about supply chains and production methods is accelerating. Pineapples, grapes, cactus, and apples are just some of the organisms on the receiving end of this influx of research into so-called bio-leathers. But it's fungi that was used by Hermès, specifically mycelium, which is the root structure of the fungi. Hermès worked with Californian company MicaWorks to make a leathery fabric called Sylvania. MicaWorks use a technology called fine mycelium. It produces strong cellular material that can be processed to give a luxury leather effect. It's incredibly exciting for the fashion industry as there is a really high level of control with the technology, meaning that not only is the range of design possibilities huge, waste is also minimized, further increasing sustainability.
An Indonesian trial to prevent the spread of dengue fever has had miraculous results, according to researchers. Dengue fever is a viral disease spread by mosquitoes. The virus, dengue virus, has become more prevalent in recent years, with an estimated 400 million infections a year. To put that increase into context, 50 years ago, outbreaks of dengue fever were recorded in just 9 countries. Typically, symptoms include a fever, headache, and a rash. But in some people, the virus can cause a more severe disease called dengue hemorrhagic fever, which can be deadly. Dengue virus is an arbovirus, meaning it is spread by arthropods, in this case the mosquito Aedes aegypti. In an effort to prevent the spread of the virus in Yogyakarta City, Indonesia, researchers have trialled using bacteria to control the virus. What they did was they infected mosquitoes with a species of bacteria called Wolbachia. Now, Wolbachia is pretty amazing and is being trialled around the world to control mosquito-borne infections. This bacterium is endosymbiotic, meaning it lives within the host and contributes to host functions. In most cases, endosymbionts have mutually beneficial relationships with the host organism, but some of their effects can also be negative. In order to survive, Wolbachia needs a healthy host, and so this bacterium will defend its host from viral invaders. In particular, they protect against RNA viruses, which include arboviruses like Zika, chikungunya, and, of course, dengue. To manipulate this protective feature, the scientists were able to successfully introduce Wolbachia into the mosquito species Aedes aegypti, which is not actually one of its natural hosts. Because Wolbachia doesn't usually infect this mosquito species, it is one of the major vectors of important human diseases. But when infected with Wolbachia, rates of viral transmission are reduced, and the results can be pretty staggering. To really test the effects of this bacterium on the spread of dengue, the researchers split Yogyakarta into 24 zones, releasing Wolbachia-infected mosquito eggs into the water of half of the zones every 2 weeks. In these zones, there was a 77% reduction in cases of dengue fever and an 86% reduction in people needing hospital care, which is a huge improvement. The researchers hope that similar measures can be rolled out in other major cities with high dengue rates, and there is promise that this could mean the end of serious outbreaks of the disease in the future.
My next story is about how bacteria are being used to tackle a silent threat. Landmines left over from past conflicts, or those still being fought, threaten millions of people around the world. Several strategies have been tried for locating landmines, such as using metal detectors and training detection animals. If you haven't heard this story, I would highly recommend looking at Magawa, who is an award-winning rat that detected 71 landmines over the 5 years he worked. It's an amazing story. Each method has its own risk and cost, and these need to be balanced. Researchers at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem have spent a decade developing live landmine sensors using E. coli. Samson Belkin, who led the research, said they create the sensors by using genetic engineering and transform each bacterium into a miniature firefly. They've done this by taking genes for bioluminescence from marine bacteria and inserting them into E. coli. The genes are engineered so they activate in the presence of a chemical associated with explosives. Bacteria are cheap and expendable, and can be spread over great distances. Also, they're relatively quick to report back, within hours or sometimes up to a day, and it's pretty obvious whether there's a landmine. They either glow or they don't. One of the problems that researchers are coming up against is how to safely detect the glow from bacteria. When they locate landmines, their brightness is really faint, so the light from the moon, stars, or nearby cities can drown them. To help solve this problem, researchers have developed a device that shields bacteria and detects their glow. It then reports its findings to a nearby computer. It's exciting, but it's still in the laboratory testing phase. The other issue is temperature. The bacterial sensors only work up to about 59 to 99 degrees Fahrenheit. That's about 12 to 37 degrees Celsius. And obviously deserts get a lot hotter than that, so figuring out how to adapt the systems to more scorching desert conditions is incredibly important. Despite this, it's really fascinating research.
Like people and animals, plants are host to thousands of microorganisms which both help them thrive and influence their genes. In the news this month was some research on how climate change can indirectly affect oak trees by changing the makeup of their mycobiome. The mycobiome is the complex community of fungi that live in an ecosystem, and this research by scientists at the University of Stockholm investigated how the mycobiome of oak tree leaves is influenced by changes in climate. Fungal communities influence a plant in many ways, be it causing disease, promoting growth, protecting against environmental stresses, and in the case of leaves, fungi play a really important role in senescence, which is where the leaves turn brown in the autumn, for example, and decomposition. So, to examine how climate change might affect these processes in oak trees, the researchers built 6 cages around 132 young oak trees. Half of these cages were heated by an extra 2 degrees Celsius using ceramic heaters, whilst the others were left untreated and represent controls. They collected leaves from the trees at various points throughout the year to examine the fungal communities present, and found a drastic change in the heated plants, with an increase in the abundance of yeast and a reduction in fungal pathogens. What the group were unable to identify is how these changes affect the trees themselves and the surrounding environment. They hope to continue with some more detailed, longer-term experiments by using this model to identify how climate change could influence the entirety of the oak trees and the forests.
My last story is pretty incredible. A blind man's sight has been partially restored by using algae proteins. Retinitis pigmentosa is a disease which leads to the death of light-sensing cells on the surface of the retina. It affects more than 2 million people worldwide, and although complete blindness is rare, the man in this story has had no vision for the past 2 decades. The man, whose identity hasn't been revealed, was treated with a type of therapy called optogenetics, which uses proteins to control cells at the back of his eye. The proteins are called channel rhodopsins and are produced in algae. The algae use them to move towards light. Optogenetics uses light to control the activity of the brain cells. In this case, scientists use the technique to restore the ability of one of the patient's eyes to detect light. The first step in the treatment was gene therapy. The genetic instructions for making the rhodopsins were taken from the algae and given to surviving cells deep in the retina at the back of the patient's eye. Now, when they were hit with light, they would send an electrical signal to the brain. However, they would only respond to amber light. So the patient wore a pair of goggles with a video camera on the front and a projector on the back. It would capture what was happening in the real world and project a vision in the right amber wavelength to the back of the eye. It took a long time for the rhodopsins to build up in the eye, and also the brain essentially had to learn a new language to be able to see again, which was understandably frustrating for the patient. However, the first signs that it worked was when he was out on a walk and was suddenly able to see the stripes of a pedestrian crossing, which was incredibly exciting for him and the researchers. While he doesn't have perfect sight, the difference between no vision and even limited vision can be life-changing, so the research is incredibly exciting for people with severely impaired vision.
And my final story this month is about how bacteria could be used to undo the damage left behind in abandoned military outposts. At various points since the Second World War, the US and Denmark have had military bases in Greenland, many of which are now abandoned. Some 30 abandoned military bases are thought to be the source of diesel fuel contamination due to oil drums rusting and leaking fuel into the environment. Scientists at the University of Copenhagen studied one such site, where 40 tons of diesel fuel had contaminated the soil. They monitored the biodegradation of the diesel by bacterial populations over 5 years and found that the contamination was removed in 82% of the 5,000 tons of soil they studied. Bacteria remove contaminants through a process called bioremediation, where they break them down, in this case the fuel, to use as an energy source. To optimize this process, the group carried out something called land farming. Which is where the contaminated soil is spread in a thin layer across the land, then it's fertilized and plowed to keep oxygen levels and nutrients high. This process optimizes the conditions to best allow a bacteria to break down the hydrocarbons that make up diesel at a faster rate. Diesel consists of over 10,000 different molecules, so a range of different microorganisms are needed to remove the pollution effectively. This process has been used before in diesel-contaminated soil, but usually it is in much warmer climates. So having it done in Greenland, which is so close to the North Pole, is a really exciting result. Contamination in the Arctic is not uncommon, and using microbes to clean up oil spills in isolated areas may be the best and most economical way of removing pollution that could otherwise be devastating to ecosystems.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed the show. As usual, all the links to the stories are in the podcast description. And if there are any stories you think we'd find interesting, don't hesitate to send them in. We'll see you on the next episode.